The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Diane Edelman for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from the Reader's Digest. Our first article is from the Inspiration column, The Great Alaska Turkey Bomb. A woman takes to the skies to make sure people in remote areas aren't forgotten for the holidays, by Caroline Fanning. It begins with a steady buzz that reverberates off towering Alaskan timber, Sitka spruce, western hemlock. It's a signal, but not one to be alarmed by. It's less duck and cover, more come and get it. So you step outside your house where there are few roads and fewer neighbors and see it. A single engine plane flies low, lower than you thought possible, just a few dozen feet off the ground if the area is clear enough, playing limbo with the tree line. The plane's door whips open, and a black package is tossed out, plummeting to earth with an attached yellow tail streaming behind. It lands not with a boom or kapow, just a dull doink or a muffled thwump if met by snow. Congratulations, you've just been turkey bombed. The bomb is a 15-pound frozen turkey stuffed into a trash bag with a long string of caution tape tied around it for easy visibility. Since 2021, Alaska native Esther Keim has been dropping them from the air to remote Alaskans who might otherwise be carving squirrel, moose, or spam for Thanksgiving dinner. Around Christmas, the sky rains holiday hams. Last year, Keim and her best friend and co-bomber, Heidi Hastings, flew together from their hangar near Anchorage across south-central Alaska, sometimes covering 140 miles in a day to deliver as many as 85 turkeys and hams to remote residents. Keim began her turkey bombing forays after visiting her family's cabin in Swentna, an isolated village about 70 miles northwest of Anchorage, with a population of just 62 hardy residents. A neighbor mentioned how a squirrel he'd bagged didn't go very far when split four ways with his family for dinner. Keim remembered a family friend who'd drop a turkey from his plane to her family in Squinta once a year when she was little, sometimes tucking a pack of gum inside the package just for her. I thought, I'm going to drop them a turkey this Thanksgiving, says Keim. It wouldn't be a big deal for me to do that, and it'd bring a lot of joy to bless other people like we were blessed. She then realized that if she could do it for that Squinta neighbor, she could do it for a lot of off-the-grid Alaskans without road access. And so the Alaska Turkey Bomb became an annual thing. Thanksgiving falls at a tricky time of the year in this part of the country. It's a time when rivers, which often serve as superhighways in Alaska's backwoods, are too frozen for boats to traverse, but not frozen enough for cars. Most people stock up and hunker down for a few weeks during this period of freeze-up, their only option for reaching civilization being 7 hours on a snowmobile. Or, if you're a pilot like Keim, you can take to the air. She posted on Facebook asking if anyone else in a remote area needed a turkey bomb, and got dozens of responses. Keim, a businesswoman whose occupations range from real estate agent to licensed esthetician, lives in Wasilla, about 45 minutes from Anchorage. She goes to her local supermarket to fill two carts with frozen turkeys. Then, armed with a list of homesteads to hit, she and Hastings take to the sky in either Keim's black four-seat 1947 Stinson or Hastings' Piper PA-18 Super Cub with a side door that opens wide for smoother bomb launches. Keim, a private pilot who has been flying for fun since she was a teenager, refurbished her plane with her father and now uses it to haul her kids from Wasilla to Squinta and other parts of Alaska that are otherwise inaccessible. Usually, Hastings is pilot, and Keim is navigator and bomber. I really have fun being the bomber, Keim says. When they reach the drop destination on the assigned day, they buzz the recipients, flying low and tipping the wing to make that sound that announces their arrival. Once Keim sees someone come out of the house, I won't drop it unless they're out to see it, because otherwise they'll never find it, she says. It's bombs away. Aiming is all one big math equation. Keim quickly calculates speed and distance from the ground to hit an open space. The turkey lands like a bowling ball, sometimes rolling as far as 100 feet on a frozen lake or river. She records a video of the bomb falling to make it easier for recipients to recover. One dropped turkey took 3 days to find, and there's a stray ham lost somewhere outside Wasilla for a very lucky scavenger come summer. Keim often drops other goodies too, like candy, cocoa, coffee, and DVDs. Dale Wall and Janine Jones, who live on a remote unnamed lake some 35 miles from the nearest store, receive surprise bombs every year. The canned food they eat at that time of year, when their lake hasn't frozen solid enough for planes to land and deliver groceries, is nutritious and good, says Jones, but everything starts to taste the same. For Wall and Jones, the turkeys are just the beginning. There's the fact that even in their isolated home, there are no roads that lead to their house. They're not really alone. Last year, Jones realized she was out of salt. But the plane that flies provisions every 2 months to their home was weeks away. Keim was due to make a drop soon, and kindly included enough salt to hold them over, along with a handwritten Christmas card. Wall and Jones keep the card taped to their door. Between turkeys and hams, plane fuel, and a hired pilot, if Keim were to pay one rather than make the runs herself, she estimates each holiday drop cycle could run about $25,000. The Alaska Turkey Bomb Project, which Keim is working to turn into a nonprofit, now receives enough donations from individuals and local businesses that she's no longer paying out of pocket. Others donate time and goods. A group of quilters gave Keim homemade quilts wrapped around stuffed animals to drop to kids for Christmas. The kids have a special place in my heart from being a kid and having that done for me, Keim says, recalling the days when she was on the receiving end of turkey bombs as a child. One parcel, her biggest yet, and for a family of six, was so stuffed that Keim struggled to get it out of the plane door. The parents set a video of their four kids opening the bags and jumping up and down with their stuffed animals with uncontrollable excitement. Keim knows how it feels. It's a cool thing to watch, she says, this noisy, sputtering plane heading straight toward you and leaving you a prize. That was The Great Alaska Turkey Bomb by Caroline Fanning. Our next piece is taken from The Nicest Places in America. Greetings from Monroe, Louisiana, by Bill Hangley, Jr. Sometimes you have to leave a place to find out how nice it is. That's what happened to Lindsay Braddock of Monroe, Louisiana. I was a wild child. I left, determined never to come back. Everybody knows everybody's business, she says. We only came back because my daughter was born with the colic, and we needed to be around my mom. It turned out to be where friends are family. As a child, she loved to run wild in Monroe's quiet green streets. As a teen, she chafed at its small-town ways. As a mother, she and her husband, Brett Braddock, learned to love the place all over again. And when they lost their son, Tarver, in a tragic fire in 2024, they found out how much the place loved them. The loss of our son has brought the community together. People aren't hurting like us, but they're hurting with us, says Brett. I've lived in lots of places, but the sense of community here, I've never felt that before. Monroe is a spacious green city on the Ouachita River, a place of slow-flowing bayous and low-slung homes surrounded by corn and soybean fields. Along with West Monroe, its cousin across the river, It's the largest urban area in northeastern Louisiana. Once a Spanish outpost, later a steamboat town, the Twin Cities are home today to 60,000 people. One of them was Tarver, just 16 years old when a late-night fire at a hunting cabin took his life. His family remembers him as a generous and gregarious kid, wild like his mom, hands-on like his dad, the type who clapped too loud in church but was always ready to join a mission to build a wheelchair ramp or fix a roof. He couldn't sit still in the pew, says Lindsay, but he loved those mission trips. It was only after he died that the family learned how many times Tarver had bought a classmate lunch or a snack. When a football teammate needed a pair of boots, Tarver gave him his. In their son's memory, the family launched the Tarver Braddock Foundation to sponsor spreading love, laughter, and happiness through random acts of kindness. Almost all its funds come from people in and around Monroe, donations as small as $5. The money goes right back to Twin City residents as small grants, gifts, and scholarships. One of those scholarships, a $5,000 check, went to Anthony Washington, a hardworking high school senior on his way to college. His mother, Rachel Washington, a pastor and Monroe native, called the surprise gift a blessing that reflects the best of the Twin Cities. The thing about Monroe is, we understand how to help each other out, Rachel says. We've had bad things happen, but we've had good things to happen here, too. I've worked for the city. I've been around mayors. I've been around council people. They truly want to help. It's that spirit that earned Monroe its nomination as one of America's nicest places. The suggestion came from Kenya Ross, who was anchoring the local TV news on the night that Tarver Braddock died. It was haunting, Ross recalls. People were just shaken. But then Ross saw the community unite around the family. The Braddock's home filled with flowers. So many well-wishers visited that the police had to put out traffic cones. Area high schools rallied to celebrate Tarver's memory. It goes to show that we can come together for each other, says Ross. Today, Ross works with Discover Monroe West Monroe, an economic development group that's helping write the newest chapters for a place whose story goes back to the 1700s. Originally the home of the indigenous Wachita people, later an outpost for French and Spanish explorers, Monroe took its name from the first steamboat that arrived in 1819, launching an agricultural boom. This whole area was King Cotton, says Laura Peppers, a genealogist at the local public library. Then they discovered natural gas, and that's when Monroe really took off. Throughout the 20th century, Monroe drew people of all kinds. Italian and Greek immigrants worked the nearby gas field. Emancipated African Americans worked the cotton field. Entrepreneurs launched businesses, including the crop dusting company that eventually became Delta Airlines. The Twin Cities grew a healthy foundation of schools, parks, libraries, museums, and nature preserves. Today, it's the region's go-to spot for higher education and health care, as well as catfish restaurants, concerts, water sports, and Christmas markets. Monroe's historic downtown boasts a new hotel, and downtown West Monroe has a new kayak dock. Old banks and warehouses are turning into offices and senior housing. A cluster of galleries and studios near the river hosts a monthly art crawl. We're not tearing down our history. We're turning it into something new, says Peppers. The area now includes a growing population of Asian, Hispanic, and other newcomers joining white and African American families who've been there for generations. A real melting pot, says Peppers. And even as the Twin Cities evolve, their traditions hold strong, including their faith tradition. Whatever faith you are, we have a church or a mosque or a temple or a synagogue, Pepper says. Whoever you are, we have a place for you. Monroe isn't perfect, of course. There's crime and poverty and feisty politics. But there's opportunity, too, and southern hospitality, and very few traffic jams. It's not too fast, and it's not too slow, says Rachel Washington. Some people need that medium speed. For the Braddocks, giving back to this diverse and growing community has proved a balm. It gives us purpose to get through the pain, says Brett. Through the Tarver Braddock Foundation, they have raised and given away more than $100,000. They've paid bills for needy neighbors, sponsored worthy causes, and handed out dozens of scholarships. The one that went to Anthony Washington came completely out of nowhere, says his grateful mom. The $5,000 scholarship will help her son, a tuba player, study music at Grambling State University, home of the legendary Tiger Marching Band. It shows us that somebody cares about us, she says. It means the world. And if the Braddocks still hurt, they also know that Tarver would be proud of what they do. They hope to keep helping Monroe for as long as Monroe will help them, which should be a long, long time. Just yesterday, there was a gift at our door, said Lindsay. The note said, "We're thinking of you. It's been 17 months, and almost daily, we get a donation." They haven't forgotten. That was Greetings from Monroe, Louisiana, by Bill Hangley, Jr. Now a third article from Everyday Heroes, A Tight-Knit Community. A nationwide group of crafters pick up their needles and finish projects for those who can't, by Maggie Gordon from the Houston Landing. Bonnie Bloomberg has always known her mother was creative and kind. When she was growing up in the 60s and 70s, her mom, Janice Goldstein, always volunteered to sew costumes for the class plays. And not just her daughter's costume. Goldstein would make them for the entire class, sewing and knitting into the wee hours. Goldstein's dedication to her craft was something Bloomberg took as a given. Then came the 40 mini strokes and the 3 massive strokes. In 2017, Goldstein lost the use of the right side of her body and began using a wheelchair. 2 years ago, Bloomberg, a senior lecturer in the math department at University of Houston downtown, sold her mother's place in favor of something smaller. While packing up, she found 3 knit sweaters in various stages of construction. She knew exactly who they were intended for. The first, a blue and white garment, was for her mother. The second, all purple, was for Bloomberg. And the third, a cardigan coming to life from a homespun pattern, was for Bloomberg's daughter. She brought them to a local knitting store to be finished. The employees there, in turn, put her in contact with another shop, where a worker asked her, "Have you ever heard of loose ends?" Bloomberg, who never took to crafting like her mother, hadn't. Loose Ends, she would learn, is an organization that matches people who have unfinished work from loved ones, who have either passed on or become incapacitated, with crafters in their area who can finish quilting, knitting, and other projects, all at no charge. Founded about 2 years ago, the nonprofit boasts almost 30,000 volunteer finishers who have taken over about 3,500 projects since its launch. Bloomberg contacted Loose Ends, and they linked her up with a nearby finisher, Anna Minmir, to take over Goldstein's work. Now in her evenings, and below the frame of her camera during work teleconferences, Minmir's fingers dance a waltz she has memorized so perfectly in the 20 years since she took up knitting as a precocious 9-year-old. Her efforts, Bloomberg says, are an act of altruism that she can never repay. "All I could do when I met Anna was give her a big hug," Bloomberg says, tearing up. "It's unbelievable how special this project is. I would have spent a fortune to get it done." Minmir spent months finishing the sweaters, and she says she's happy to have a part in what she sees as a beautiful story that binds generations. The project reminds her of her own family. Her grandmother was a knitter as well, until her arthritis made it hard to complete those delicate waltz-like movements. She stumbled upon the Loose Ends project when a knitter she follows on Instagram mentioned she had signed up to be a finisher. "Honestly, it feels a little selfish," Minmir says, laughing. I get to do my hobby, and I don't have to pay for any of the supplies. It's also an opportunity for her to work with patterns she never would have picked for herself, stretching her skill set and keeping her mind as sharp as her needles. With every flick of her needles, the project pushes closer to completion. Midmere will miss it, though she is looking forward to that moment when Bloomberg can hold and hug the memories that her mom, who passed away in September of last year, started to knit into existence. That, says Loose End's co-founder Jennifer Simonek, is the beauty and value in the organization. It's not just being nice, Simonek says. It's making sure people have these tangible objects that you can hug when you're missing a person. That is a big deal. That was A Tight-Knit Community by Maggie Gordon. Our last article is from the Life Well Lived column, Dancing into Middle Age. A Surprising New Hobby Taught Me There's More Than One Way to Be Flexible, by Julia Zarankin from CBC Canada. By my early 40s, I had exhausted all the hobbies that were supposed to make me feel better about entering middle age. I had taken an improv class, started learning a new language, launched myself into an unsuccessful pursuit of a craft only to amass a collection of unevenly stitched handmade books, and given yoga a second chance. I had even bought a recliner to help alleviate the malaise. And then, at the height of my low-grade desperation, I decided to sign up for a ballet class. "But you're not very flexible," my husband gently reminded me. He wasn't wrong. I nearly injured myself the one time I tried to lift my leg onto our bathroom vanity in an attempt to stretch. Also, my track record for committing to physical activity wasn't great. Between short stints on the recreational badminton court, a brief flirtation with cycling, and an on-and-off relationship with swimming, and near total abandonment of my dumbbell lifting regimen, I could see how I didn't exactly look like a prospective ballerina material. But I was determined to give it a try. I needed confirmation that my body was capable of movement and grace. Before leaving the house for my first intro class for adults at the National Ballet School in Toronto, Canada, I grabbed a rhinestone headband that had been languishing in my drawer for years. I figured that if I would be standing in front of a mirror, in front of a group of strangers, with all my postural infelicities exposed, I might as well do it in a rhinestone headband. I hadn't expected any of it to stick. After all, this wasn't my first time in a ballet studio. But this time around, the exact same things that had made me flee the studio as a 10-year-old now brought a certain joy. The repetitive nature of exercises at the bar, the sheer physical exertion, the fact that my every move invited my teacher's critical dissection. And though I'd expected my classes to be physically demanding and my calf muscle to ache, I hadn't anticipated that my teacher's command to take up more space would change my way of being in the world. When I lamented my lack of grace in the deceptively simple act of pointing and extending my foot to the side in a tendu, my teacher reminded me that ballet isn't about perfection. Rather, he said, it's about striving for perfection. As a writer who wrangles sentences all day with the hope that they will approximate the beautiful, perfect construct in her mind, reader, they rarely do, if ever, this felt like the best, most searing writing advice I'd ever received. Slowly, I started becoming more comfortable with the body I saw staring back at me in the mirror. My posture still needs finessing. My jumps are never as high as they feel. My hips wobble during my rond de jambe, and my pirouette is still lopsided on the best of days. But the idea that my body hasn't ossified and that it's still a work in progress encourages me. If anything, ballet is forcing me to rethink my relationship with my body, and instead of noticing only the beginnings of older age descending upon me, I now marvel at what my body is capable of and the incremental changes I've seen as I've learned to stand with more confidence and courage. As for the imperfections, they're part of being alive. 8 years into my ballet classes, I'm what you would call a lifelong advanced beginner. At the tender age of 50, I am finally a ballerina, though not the kind that anybody would pay money to see on stage. Why do I continue? Because when I do my almost daily ballet class, I focus on my breathing and move my body in ways that always challenge me and remind me of everything that is possible. Recently, my teacher taught us a watered-down, beginner-appropriate version of the Rose Adagio choreography from Sleeping Beauty. As I stood in my living room, balancing in a shaky coup de pied in relevé and bedecked in a rhinestone headband, dancing for nobody but myself, I felt every inch a ballerina. That was Dancing into Middle Age by Julia Zarankin from CBC Canada. I'm going to squeeze in one last little piece, Shelby the Great Dane. When Shelby landed at our rescue, she was nearly blind puppy with chronic eye pain. Most of our animals get adopted, but after nursing her through four surgeries, we knew she was ours for good. Shelby has a gift for comforting our changing menagerie of sick and injured animals. Midnight bottles for newborn kittens go much smoother with her silky head nearby, and terrified dogs seem to have no problem socializing if it's with Shelby. We rescued a huge unadoptable dog, Malaki, who is part wolf and missed critical human interaction stages as a puppy. He doesn't take comfort from people, but Shelby managed to win him over. Maybe he just wanted a playmate as big as he is. Another time, we took in a French bulldog puppy, Levi, who wasn't expected to survive. Shelby was fascinated by him. Levi eventually got stronger, but for a while he weighed only a pound. So he and the 125-pound Shelby made quite a pair. If that's not enough, she's been an infallible source of comfort to me through a stressful career as an animal control officer and rescuer. That's it for today. We've run out of time. I'm Diane Edelman for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Reader's Digest is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call area code 919-832-5138. That number again, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. Thank you.